Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Treewell. I have a very special guest tonight, the host of Paranormal Patio, Jason Andrews. Okay, that's my introduction.
Perfect. And I, you know, mine, you've listened enough of my crap.
Oh, yes.
Here we go.
Hey, it's not crap.
Yeah, welcome back to Paranormal Patio. As always, I'm Jason, but you knew that when you clicked the button to listen to this wonderful show, this great episode with my guest, Vincent Treewell. Vincent, welcome to the Paranormal Patio.
Thank you. Happy to be here. I certainly look forward to it.
All right, there we go. Now we have both intros.
Yes, excellent. So, yes, the way this came to be is I was listening to one of the episodes of Paranormal Patio, and you had a fascinating guest on who is a in the real world cave explorer who goes into caves and, you know, has all the gear and the ropes and things and really explores caves. And also, there was a lot of talk about hollow earth theory. Could you tell us a little bit about the hollow earth theory and what it involves?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of different directions you can go looking into hollow earth. There's the idea that there exists an entire inner earth, as in the globe of the earth is hollow and the interior hosts many different civilizations. There's also the possibility that there are pockets or large tunnels and caverns that extend well into the earth that each house different civilizations. And there's my favorite theory, which is the one I kind of lean on, that all of these interactions that people have had with entities from the hollow earth are non-physical. And that's just kind of the way I justified it in my experience, just because it sounds a little less crazy, but somehow also crazy. And so
that honestly makes a lot of sense. I think with some things that we're going to get into a little bit later, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Basically like the alien abduction stories from the time of the Venusian visits, where every alien abduction was people from Venus. There was that little window there, and they would take people to Venus and show them their civilizations and talk with them. They would meet other Venusians. Obviously, what we know now is that you can't go to Venus because your physical body would, you know, just turn to ash almost immediately. So to me, that entails a non-physical visit to another plane of existence where you could be in this place. And I just think it's very similar to stories of the hollow earth.
Including
my favorite hollow earth story, which, you know, is Eta Dorpa. And I think that it is very much in the same vein.
Yes, that I was just going to add that that's a very good analogy, because I know the Soviets sent a couple of probes to Venus in the 70s and they melted within minutes. And the visitors, like Adamski's Orthon, look exactly like normal human beings you might pass on the street, except they're usually better looking. But they wouldn't evolve like that, you know?
Correct.
So that would be, as a non-physical experience, is to me a hell of a lot more realistic, you know?
Yeah, it's also fascinating with Eta Dorpa that it's Aphrodite spelled backwards, right? And Aphrodite is the corresponding name for Venus. So it's right there in the name. You know, that's what really pushed me in that direction.
Yes, and could you elaborate on Eta Dorpa? I don't think most people, including myself, know a whole lot about what that is.
Well, I could point you to joining my Patreon and watching the documentary, but I won't do that.
I'm already a member, and I have it on my to-do list. Yes.
So basically, the story of Eta Dorpa begins with a man named Llewellyn Drury, and he's visited by a mysterious old man in the 1800s. And this old man says, I'm going to tell you my story, and in 30 years I want you to publish it. And the man agrees, and it begins this sequence of visits from the man that calls himself I Am the Man, or the man who did it. And he tells a story of how he infiltrated a secret society in New York. Doesn't say what the name of the society is, but when you do a little digging, you find that it's most likely the Freemasons, and that I Am the Man is most likely William Morgan. And you can dig into the William Morgan affair pretty easily. Interesting time in history. So then he lays out the story of what happens after he is kidnapped. He's aged in a magic ceremonial ritual around Fort Niagara. And then he is taken on a journey to Kentucky and finds a cave entrance and a spring where he is guided by a sightless, eyeless humanoid that has emerged from said cave to the Hollow Earth. And he faces all these trials and receives all of these prophecies. And several years later, he comes out and he tells a story to Llewellyn Drury. And if you go by the narrative of the book, Drury decides he can't publish this. He hands it off to John Uri Lloyd. And John Uri Lloyd is a pharmacologist in Cincinnati, pretty big at the time. And he publishes the book. It's his first novel. And it's kind of weird that a pharmacologist would publish a Hollow Earth story. So I don't know. To me, it could very much be based on reality, especially when you look at a lot of the facts like I have and do a little research and boots on the ground type of work with it. So that's basically Edidorpa in a nutshell.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. And there are just so many rabbit holes there. About what time period would the book have been published? Which is go ahead.
It was published in, I believe, 1895.
Which is 30 years after the old man first came to him.
Correct. So that would be 65. William Morgan disappears, I believe, in 25. So that leaves that time window for this man to have all these experiences and make his way back. And for whatever reason, choose Llewellyn Drury to be the bearer of this tale.
It's one of those things that is, whatever you think of it, it's something and it's fascinating. I definitely need to catch up on that. And, fall down some of those rabbit holes and see what's going on with that. Wow.
You'll find me down there. I've been living in them for several years now.
I believe it. Your guest had done the other week had done caving. Do you have any cave experience?
Nothing in the same vein as Jason Joyce has, the guest that you mentioned. I've done some touristy caves and I've done some really simple, easy caving in Kentucky and in Illinois, I guess. So nothing where I felt like I needed to have a rope and, flares and all that type of stuff. Helmet definitely would have been a good idea in a couple of them, but I'm tall and I've got a giant bulbous head, so it's gonna happen whether I have a helmet on or not. And I've not had any visitors from the inner earth in any of the caves that I've been in, but you get the same vibe that you read in all of these stories.
Yes, I have. My experience is extremely limited. I've been to the Cave of the Malvins, but it's still, and an abandoned lead mine that they do tours on in Wisconsin, but as a youth, but you do get that vibe. It's different underground. And as you emphasized in that episode, we know more about far reaches of space than we do about what's a few miles straight down. And that's, I have practically no caving experience because for similar reasons, I'm a stout fellow and I don't want to get stuck in anything. And I like the space program. I think cave exploration is a great, interesting thing for other people to do. And I'll just hear their results. And, you know, I don't need to get firsthand on that.
Like, you know, what you really need to do, though, is you should definitely go to Mammoth Cave. Because for me personally, coming down into the first main dome of Mammoth Cave really opens your mind to the possibilities of what we're walking over every day. You walk in and there's this enormous chamber and the ceiling several stories high. It's all opened up and you're underground and seeing all of this. And I think that you would really benefit from going in somewhere like that, that is safe and you're not going to be in danger of a cave-in or something like that, or hitting your head and passing out and, you know, whatever. I think Mammoth Cave would be great for you if you're interested in Hollow Earth stuff, just because it really does open your mind up to the possibilities.
Oh, yes. That sounds like an excellent idea. Definitely something to check out. Yeah, because there is great areas underground, which are very limited how much they're explored. The one thing I've noticed is that no matter how deep we go, we never don't find life.
Yeah.
You know, in all the mining and all the exploration, there's never been a point at which, okay, nothing lives here. There's always stuff living down there. Absolutely. And that in itself, you know, life continues to evolve and adapts to its environment. So, you know, if something's been living down there for a million years, we have no idea what's down there. And I'd say that's pretty much inarguable.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of underwater rivers and things where these tours operate now, especially in southern Indiana. I think I've been to two or three down there where you get in a boat and you go into this cave, and there's always the blind fish and blind lizards that are completely white or see-through, just that have adapted to live in that environment. And that just goes to your point that no matter where you are, there's going to be some sort of life. And it's fascinating to think. I mean, and like Jason said about finding shark tooths under Kentucky, you know, there's these pockets that exist under the ground where if there's not life now in the same sense, at one point there was, and if there's these pockets that are isolated, there could still be thriving ecosystems that we don't know about that have adapted to live in that environment and carried on. And that is absolutely fascinating to me.
Yes it is. And I won't deny, there's like, I love to read about it and I love to hear about it, but there is no way in hell I would put on a scuba suit and like actually go into an underground body of water just because of sheer cowardice. There's,
you know, I couldn't do it either.
If something touched me, I'd probably die of fright before anything else happened.
Yeah, yeah. So yes, I'm curious sharks. Though, because I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm curious because I asked Jason, I said, if you got to a point where you were stuck and you couldn't go back, would you keep going or would you sit there and wait for help?
I'm going to try to live. I don't expect that whatever I'm going to go forward is going to probably be interested in helping me. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's my take. But you know, I don't really go into situations like that because, wow, it's just, yeah, a pretty terrifying environment, I would say.
Sure.
Even if the albino blind sharks don't get you, I mean, something else might.
Yeah, we've all seen the movies.
Yes, exactly. But I think that stuff is scary because it's kind of innately, you know, we are not the alpha species there, the alpha predator, the apex predator, I guess is the word I'm looking for. Whatever else actually lives there is definitely the apex predator. And I don't like not being the apex predator, you know. That's just me, but yes. Let's see. There's one, or there's several things I didn't want to miss mentioning. And, you know, the show, we speculate about a lot of stuff. Nothing's written in stone. We're, you know, two people talking. But you have a particular cave that's fairly close to your, a place that you've spent a lot of time. Do you want to tell us about that?
Oh, which one?
Well, why don't we start with Burroughs?
Okay, yeah. So I know a little bit about Richard Burroughs, and none of it's good. so he was a man that was born or lived in Richland County, Illinois, which is about 45 minutes from me. And it's actually, I was born in Olney, which is home of the white squirrels, if you're into that sort of thing. And
I just got to stop you right there for a second. What do you mean, home of the white squirrels? Could you elaborate?
There's this weird sort of civilization of albino squirrels that live in Olney. There are tons of them. And you go to like the Olney City Park and you can, you know, sit there with your drive through burger and fries and watch the white squirrels running around and climbing trees and stuff. It's weird.
Wow. Okay. Well, I learned something today. I'm going to have to look that up because that is fascinating.
And it's they're not all white squirrels. Like there are also gray squirrels and red squirrels, but there's a significant white squirrel population. And if you get caught killing them, I'm pretty sure you get in trouble.
Oh yes. They're probably highly endangered. I'm just surprised there's like, sometimes there'll be albino deer or something or a bear, but it'll just be like one. There usually isn't like a breeding population. That's fascinating.
Well, and it's weird too, because they're squirrels. You know what I mean? How many squirrels die every day? And they rely on that gray fur for camouflage in the trees. And these white ones stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, luckily we don't have a lot of large birds of prey, you know? So, but it is weird.
Yeah.
They are cool. Definitely look it up.
Yes, I certainly will.
I was born there.
Yeah, please.
I was born amongst the white squirrel people, and I didn't grow up there or anything. It's just the hospital that I was taken in. And Richard Burroughs, back, I don't remember the day or the time frame, says that he is out looking for arrowheads, stumbles into this cavern, and he finds what's been called now Burroughs Cave, which has all of these artifacts from different time periods and different civilizations around the world. And people are pretty quick to dismiss them all as phonies. And it's possible, you know, that they are. It's also possible that it's true and untrue, that there are actual artifacts as well as, engineered artifacts, so to speak.
Yes. And I just want to butt in for a second, because in the second episode ever of The Weird Part, I talked about Burroughs Cave in the context of anthropologist Dr. Joseph Mahan, who I think it was the 80s when Burroughs came out with his cave revelations. And Dr. Mahan, who was a real life PhD holding anthropologist and was a museum curator and whose papers and possessions are at the University of Georgia at Columbus, he totally believed in Burroughs. He totally believed in the cave, and he apparently had visited it repeatedly. And now, for what it's worth, Dr. Mann could have been wrong. He could have been conned. This was a few years before he died, and he was up there in age, but he vouched for Burroughs. So for what it's worth, that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is also, I think, worth pointing out that the location had never been disclosed by Burroughs. And
no, they kept that real secret. Yes.
Yes. So I started looking into this because a couple weeks ago I caught you on Conspiranormal, and I believe it came up in the interview, and I had sent you a message. And
yes, thanks.
I was I've always been curious about it, but not, I've never really done much research on burrows. What I knew is very limited, but I was just drawn because of the location, and I thought that the cave itself was in Richland County. And then I stumbled across just a couple of nights ago, preparing myself for this episode, this other cat down in Southern Illinois who does not believe that Burroughs was a good man, and thinks that he basically plundered this tomb and started selling all these artifacts for next to nothing, because at the time no one was willing to pay big money for them. I mean, there could have, you know, a lot of forgery and things like that, and then there's a lot of criticism because it doesn't fit the historical narrative.
It doesn't at all. No, it's totally alternative.
So there's this guy, his name is Harry Hubbard, down in Southern Illinois. I forget exactly where he is, maybe around Harrisburg or something, but he has wrote a couple of books. He's been on a big like History Channel, Discovery Channel show. I can't remember which one it is, but he has a series of videos on YouTube that go back into the 90s talking about the things that were found there, the research that he has done, and he believes that the cave was actually the tomb of Alexander the Great and his people, which we talked a little bit about this before we started. It's hard to digest. It's hard to wrap your head around.
That is a huge assertion, you know, I'm not saying isn't true, but it is, you know, it's quite something. Go ahead.
So he alleges then that the artifacts would have been brought with that group of people coming up the Mississippi River from around Cuba and into the Ohio and eventually into the forest of Southern Illinois. And it's interesting, you know, I need to dig more into it and get my own opinion on it and dig into Hubbard a little bit, because he's a little out there. he's a lot out there. Just because I'm bringing his name up does not mean that I am endorsing him in any way.
I've absolutely understood. Just a discussion. Yes,
absolutely. Well, but it's worth noting because he has information that we didn't know about, because he's not calling it Burroughs Cave. He's calling it the Illinois Mystery Cave. And I need to go back and find the video that I had stopped on, because I was trying to triangulate where the location of this cave is, because in one of his videos, he shows a map. Excuse me. He shows a map and describes the topography and the elevations, and I was trying to match it up with an actual map of the state and trying to figure out where this cave is. And I was close, but I've forgotten all of it. So I have to go back and do it again. Yeah, I wasn't taking notes. I was just curious, like maybe I can figure this guy out. You know what I mean? Actually, he's not quite what I would consider in Southern Illinois. I mean, it's Southern Illinois, but to me, Southern Illinois kind of represents the Shawnee Forest. That's what I think of. If I'm in conversation and I say Southern Illinois, I mean the forest down to the Ohio. And the Shawnee Forest is just massive. But this guy, I remember now, of the county, and I live in the state, but it's around Salem, Illinois, which is kind of cool too, just the with the naming of things and how these things go in circles.
Kind of a synchronicity. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's around there somewhere in that county, in the southern part of that county. And if I find the map, I will share that with you. And if I can figure out exactly where we think this cave might be, he hasn't said to my knowledge outright, this is the location of it, but he has went there with a camera and showed the entrance, but never so far that I have found filmed inside the actual cave. There is a map of the cave, which I believe came from Burroughs originally. This Hubbard guy might have also made a map of the cave. But the thing with Hubbard is he's also really into Hollow Earth and aliens. And that was like a weird twist as I'm digging into this Burroughs cave and Richard Burroughs being this master forgery artist and conning all of these people and buying artifacts that he made. I just think maybe Burroughs found stuff. It didn't make any sense. And he made up his narrative of this underground trading site from Native American times. And I think maybe the Alexander the Great story is not so crazy in context.
That's very interesting. That, and yes, though I'll be honest, it's the, if Alexander the Great is buried there, that's his tomb, that's still less weird than Hollow Earth and aliens. So we know, you know, that we know Alexander the Great existed, and you know, we know he conquered lands and things. If you can, what does he say about the Hollow Earth and a connection with aliens?
So based on my limited knowledge of this guy and his work, he has found artifacts that depict alien imagery, non-human humanoid figures in drawings and carvings on these artifacts. And I haven't made the connection exactly with the Hollow Earth things. I assume it's more in the same vein. But if it's not connected to that particular cave, it is a part of this guy's research and work, because he's very well versed in it from what I've seen. He has a lot of really old maps. He references a lot of really old, like, books that have not even been translated to English, because I tried looking for a few of them. And he seems like a really smart guy. He knows his history very well. Ancient history very well.
You say translated from what to what?
Latin.
Oh, okay, okay.
Wow. It's a big book. Anyone who's into Hollow Earth would probably laugh at me for not even remembering what it's called or who the author was. But it's a multiple volume collection of Hollow Earth information from ancient Rome, I believe.
Wow.
And it's just, from looking at it that night, trying to find copies of this book, there is not an English translation. There are a couple of others, maybe German and French or something like that, some other European language. But I'd love to read it if I could understand what it was. Just
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, that is,
because that's a long time ago. That's,
yes,
you know, a lot of people chalk up the Hollow Earth to Jules Verne. You know,
yes,
that,
yes,
that's sort of the Journey, the gestation.
Journey to the Center of the Earth is, I mean, exactly. It's a classic. Yeah,
you know, so those of us who entertain the idea of the possibility of there being an inner earth or a hollow earth, we kind of get lumped into falling for the stories of Jules Verne. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I confess to have never even read the classic work of Jules Verne, known as Journey to the Center of the Earth. So you can't fault me for that directly. However, I did spend 2 years trying to find the location of the Hollow Earth entrance in Kentucky, so you know what I mean.
I don't make light of that at all. I personally have difficulty with the idea of a full-on, like, Jules Verne-style inner world inside what is supposed to be a molten metallic core to the earth.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the massive cavern systems that we know exist caused me to not dismiss the idea that certainly there could be a lot going on under there. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's very realistic.
Yeah, like I said, you know, there are distinct ways to follow the story. You know, there's the whole entire inner earth thing, there's the pocket theories, there's, you know, we go back to, again, my favorite, the non-physical communication and visitation to these places.
And just let me interrupt here for a moment, but to me that would make so much sense, it because it correlates at least vaguely with the idea of the center of the earth being Hades and being a place where shades, where the dead live.
Yeah.
And that would kind of make a lot of sense. And that seems to be a recurring idea across different cultures.
Correct.
When you die, you go underground to the center of the earth. And I don't so much mean the Christian hell, but more the pagan Hades, where everybody's down there. It's not just bad people, it's everybody,
Yeah, but it's also important to look at that as it doesn't seem to represent a cave setting. You know, you think into the earth or under the earth, you think it's going to be dark and rocky, completely enclosed, no natural light. But when you look at specifically into actual Hades as a Greek mythological figure, as the brother of Zeus, the ruler of the underworld, the Zeus of the underworld, he exists in a place where the souls of the dead are judged for their actions, and they are dispersed to different areas, which are not caves. It's open fields. It's centers of beauty and joy for all eternity. And none of them have ever really been depicted as being underground. It's like it's sort of the Christian concept of heaven, right? That there's beautiful skies and green grasses and pastures and fields and rolling hills. And to take that approach and make that connection to the underworld of Greek mythology and Egyptian mythology and Nordic mythology, and like you said, there's all these different, you know, pasts, but to take that leap and say that this is the same thing implies either a non-physical or an entire hollow interior, which would have a source of sunlight, which would mean an inner sun as well.
Yes, the inner sun that I don't claim to have the esoteric knowledge to really talk intelligently about, but I certainly, it keeps coming up in other things I read about all the time.
Yeah.
And yes, you'd need that light source that somehow makes it all possible. Or exactly. We're all spirits and we're on a different vibration. We're on a different phase and we're in the Elysian fields. And it's beautiful because we're not in our physical, you know, flesh and blood bodies.
That's the way I lean too, man.
And that makes quite a lot of sense to me, you know.
Exactly.
Speaking of aliens and underground civilizations, are you at all familiar with the Shaver Mysteries?
I am. Not well enough to sit down and rewrite the entire story. I've read a lot of it. I haven't read it all. There are weird things that come with that because there are people who claim to encounter these same creatures, these Darrow. I did an episode, I think it might have even been the very first episode of my show, where we talked about different things, aliens underground. And the Shaver Mystery, of course, comes up easily in topic for discussion. And there's this guy, he has since passed away. He had a YouTube channel. He was from Texas, and he told this story about a Darrow coming to him and trying to mind control him. And this Darrow is scared by some other entity and flees. And he didn't know what it was he was encountering. He had never heard of the Shaver Mystery, never read it. But he drew a picture of the entity and described it exactly. It's a Darrow. And he came later to find that this entity had already been described and written about, you know, through Ray Palmer and Amazing Stories and the Shaver Mystery. So it's weird, you know, that other people would be encountering these things.
Well, that's the thing that sticks with me, that Ray Palmer is the publisher. And what's his name? Shaver here is, I just looked it up real quick. Richard Sharp Shaver.
Yeah. That can't be his real name.
That's his Sharp Shaver. Yes. That's his name.
Nick Sharp Shaver.
Can't be. In 1945, he publishes his first story, and it makes the leap from Amazing Stories, which is just straight science fiction. It doesn't purport to be real, into Fate magazine, which does purport to be real. And I could totally write Shaveroff as just a crazy guy, which is dismissive and you know, not a good thing to do. But I could say, look, this is just fiction, okay? Except other people started writing and saying, yes, I had the experience too. And I was taken underground. And yes, these things come out of the ground. And yes, they mind control me with beams. And other people report seeing the Daros and the Taros. There are the kind of good guy entities that, and other people experience this and report it as real. And that's how it kind of comes into existence and builds up steam, because people are saying this actually happened to me. And that was pretty amazing, you know, in my opinion, you know.
Well, you know, I always felt that way too. And I don't remember if it was Nathan Isaac or someone else I had heard talking about this, that people with schizophrenia, one of the most common themes that they have is that they believe that themselves or others are being mind controlled by robots or devices underground. And that sounds dismissive as well. But if you approach schizophrenia as, which has been documented, exactly the same under an MRI as being on LSD, and you look at schizophrenia as having it is not so much something that is wrong with you, but having it is not having a filter to filter out all the static that everyone else filters out the same way. And you're picking up signals from other things, other entities, other planes of existence, and you're not able to discern one from the other. And you can't make up your own reality the way others do. You know, it's just, it's a correlation, you know, that maybe these people are picking up on this stuff, and it does exist in a way, you know, that maybe there aren't Darrow and Taro under the earth in Georgia, but there exists a plane of reality that we, as a well, healthy minded group of individuals, don't recognize, but these people can, because they don't have the same filters in place.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And it reminds me of where we used to be as a society with our understanding of autism, and that we used to just look at it as a disability instead of a difference, a neurological difference. Different, but not better or worse, just different. And maybe in the future, people who have schizophrenia, it won't be as disabling, because we'll be able to understand it better, and they will be able to like better interpret all the information they're receiving.
Yeah.
Maybe they're just receiving way more information than us in the so-called normal population. And if you're suddenly fed all this information and you have no context for interpreting it, you have no context for, you know, putting it into your worldview, it would be, you know, it could be devastating. But that doesn't, you know, if suddenly you could hear like all the radio stations that are broadcasting all at once, I mean, you'd be in a bad situation. But that doesn't mean radio isn't real. And it doesn't mean that if you have a means of controlling it and understanding it, then it doesn't have to be a disability. It could be something positive. I'm just going to speculate that I'm probably not the first person to think that, and that some of the people who thought of that work for the government. And, you know, that, and this is something that, you know, Nathan Isaac has talked about, and, you know, others have talked about, that the government seemed very interested at certain times in schizophrenic people and how to harness them, how how can we weaponize whatever you have and you know, and study them in a way that they weren't doing that because they were particularly interested in the mentally ill. They were doing that because maybe they're receiving something and maybe we can use that to hear whatever you're hearing. And that comes up again and again. And it's,
well, it's got built-in connections to MK Ultra. I mean, it's been declassified that they were using LSD as a means to induce this state in people at way crazy high dosage levels. And to, even if it's not somebody who has schizophrenia, it's a normal person, and you load them up with an just insane amount of LSD.
Terrence McKenna level, yes.
Yes, or worse. And we know now that being on LSD is the same as schizophrenia. They are throwing people into this existence now that they have schizophrenia suddenly and not growing up with it and developing with it. And I can't imagine being in that state. It would be horrifying. So all of a sudden, you know, you go from like the equivalent of an 8-track tape to now you have satellite radio. And you're hearing all the stations at once.
Yes, yes. It would be, yeah, it would be like that. It would be really difficult, if not impossible, to keep your, if you weren't insane before, you would be after.
Oh, yeah. It's wild. It's wild to think that we as people could do that to another person. Like, it's just, it seems to be the most immoral and unethical thing I could think of.
Yeah, because yes it is.
You know, like, you could argue, and I would not disagree, that just killing people for no reason is a bad thing, but I would almost venture to say that being put through a program where they're pumped with LSD might be worse than being killed.
I mean, I can understand the mentality of a agent who, for reasons of a mission and national security, has to shoot somebody in the back of the head. I can get that mindset. But to dose somebody with psychotropics at huge levels and then methodically study them, no, that's some Nazi shit, man.
Yeah, it's pretty messed up.
It is.
You know, but it's really interesting now because you look at the way that the United States is approaching psychedelic use now. And I think in the next 10 years, we're going to be having this conversation in a different way because they're starting now to realize things about the benefits of psychedelics on mental health, not just LSD, but mushrooms specifically. Psilocybin is just growing. I mean, there are several places now where it's legal to use, you know, just as an adult on the street, like buying a beer. And I think that when the big pharma companies figure out a way that they can put their name on it and make it valuable to them, that we'll see a lot more treatment through psychedelics. And it will be interesting to see the effect it has, not just on people with schizophrenia, but people with depression and people that have different mental health levels, and how it changes the landscape of all this weird shit that we're into. I really am curious for the future, you know, a world where people are taking mushrooms every day instead of Xanax, and how those people are able to make connections in a different way than what we have. And I'm curious if it will lead us to a sort of artistic and spiritual renaissance in a way. I think it would be just huge for civilization right now, at a time where everything is just awful, to suddenly find yourself being able to find creativity and find peace and rest and be able to communicate in ways that you haven't been able to before. I think that would just be amazing.
I agree. I'm actually quite familiar with what you're talking about because, and I'll just, you know, full disclosure, I have no problem talking about it. I have severe PTSD and I get treatment through the VA. And they, it's not authorized yet, but it's come up that psychedelics, specifically mushrooms, are being used experimentally to treat PTSD, as well as depression and alcoholism.
Yeah.
And that is a real thing, and they are pursuing it. And it wouldn't surprise me if you're right that in 10 years from now, that's a mainstream treatment. Now, I would only do psychedelics in a controlled environment with like a psychologist holding my hand, because there's just a lot of stuff I don't want to see. But I think that in the future, I'd be even open to doing it myself.
Sure.
And it's certainly, I mean, I think it holds a lot of potential for treatment.
And well, that's the way they're marketing it as well, too, now, is that it's being recommended or suggested that it could be beneficial when applied to traditional therapy. So I think that is going to be the groundwork, you know, that we'll see first. There will be someone with you making sure that you feel safe and secure, you know, that someone that's there to help you process things now that you have these other tools at your disposal. So I think that's the way it'll start.
Yes. And I think that, well, I think they're doing that already for like the last couple of years, maybe just very, it's very low key and it's experimental, but they are doing, what's the word I want to use? Test studies to, and they're getting great results from everything I've read. They're getting great results. So yeah, I see that as really being the wave of the future.
Who would have thought that the creatures that were born of the planet Earth could be treated by natural, clearly biological substances that the Earth also provides, as opposed to crazy chemicals cooked up in some government lab?
Yes, indeed. Yes, you don't have to go in full on Gaia hypothesis to say that, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe we should do the natural stuff first, you know?
Yeah, right. We took the wrong door a long time ago.
But you see, the stockholders don't make any money off of, yeah, you know,
no, that's it.
We
that's
can't it, patent exactly. it, you know?
That's what I'm saying. When they find a way to do that, when they find a way to put sodium bicarbonate in a tablet with mushrooms, and they can say, this is our formula, this is our patented trademark, now we can sell it, and they will.
Yes, that sounds about right. Not to change the subject drastically, but speaking of the military, do you have any interest in or anything you'd like to say about what are called DUMs, deep underground military bases?
Well, a lot of that goes back to the glorified con man Richard Doty, and the disinformation campaign, you know, back from the 40s onward. I think we're still feeling the effects of everything that's happened and probably still being subjected to it, but there's this cover-up story to protect military assets, and it goes too far. And now you've got a guy who is filming and taking photos of military bases, claiming to see UFOs, when really he's photographing, you know, top secret new weapons of mass destruction. And they don't want him to come out and say that's what he's filming. So they're like, yeah, that's a UFO. You should look into that. And he does, and comes to these series of you know, different theories that he has, and it totally consumes his life and eventually leads to the topic of an underground alien base or an underground human and alien venture, where we have extraterrestrials and the military working together in these places. I think that really blossomed into a lot of these stories. A lot of them are the same. I mean, you look at what's his name? Oh my goodness, it escapes me.
Are you talking about Paul Benowitz, the guy that
Yeah, Binowitz was the original. Yeah, the Binowitz papers, the Binowitz affair that led to the
Doty's misinformation. Stuff. Yeah, Doty's misinformation definitely, you know, the phrase drove crazy sounds extreme, but no, he did Absolutely. That with Paul Benowitz and produced enough fake evidence to just lead him on this story that, you know, there was this deep underground base at Dulce and there's shootouts between humans and aliens. It's just crazy sci-fi crap. But when
it's a scheme, though,
when
this is, yeah, oh, yes. other people,
and that's never, that storyline has never died out. And what's really embarrassing about ufology these days is Doty's still on the circuit. He still like goes to conferences and gets paid to talk about stuff when he's like pretty much been exposed and exposed and exposed, but people still pay to hear it.
So, yeah. Yes. Doty, I had this conversation with a past guest this season about the importance of the trickster element in getting to the root of what's, you know, really going on all around us, and how maybe you have to be in that particular mind state to experience these things. And maybe that trickster element needs to exist in order to elevate your, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, your energetic level or your mental state that controls your bio state, you know, that controls the chemicals that are being released from your brain to make you receptive to aliens and ghosts and Bigfoot and Pan and UFOs and all of these things, which I think are all the same thing. I think the trickster element is necessary at times. I think there has to be this sort of tulpa or egregore creation based on something. And the trickster element is perfect for that, because you can say, yeah, you're absolutely looking at UFOs. And now all of a sudden you're looking at UFOs. I've talked to Alan Greenfield about this and about how Ray Barker said he was going to incite a UFO sighting over this canal outside of their hotel one night. And he calls the police and says, hey, I see these lights flying over the canal. And the next day on the news, there's reports from dozens of people that saw these lights over the canal. You know, I, there's something to it. I think there is. So there is value in Richard Doty. I just don't like him as a person.
Oh, I concur. But no, that's a really fascinating take on it, because I think that you're right that so often there's an element of fakery and the trickster element that, you know, runs against, I think, so many of us, including definitely myself, want this cut and dried, want it nailed down. I want to know what this thing is. And I want to, you know, I want Bigfoot in the zoo, and I want Loch Ness Monster, you know, in the water. And I want to see, I want ghosts to be explained. And that's never going to happen. None of that stuff is going to happen. No. But there's like this gray area where fakery, and it's just like outright fakery, like Ray Barker stuff, becomes reality, becomes at least for a temporary time, something that people do see. And yes. Keel talked a lot about that and how he would mention some idea and then see that very thing. And like, he wrote something about seeing gill men, people that had gills like fish, and then in the real world encountered a gill man. And it was like, now he was, what he was talking about at the time was like fictional, but it became real, at least for a little while.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes me think that we really fundamentally don't understand the nature of the reality we live in.
Absolutely not. And I want to just share something that's relative to my perception of all of this, is that whenever I started really looking into I don't know, whatever you want to call it. You want to call it magic, or you want to call it the paranormal, you know, under a large umbrella. The first thing that drew me in was astral projection. And when I got into learning about astral projection, I quickly found the work of Jane Roberts and Seth. And Jane Roberts channeled this entity from New York, this Seth entity, who claimed to have never had a physical body. He was a non-biological intelligence that existed in some way that he couldn't explain. And Seth talked about the nature of personal reality, and that we all create our reality both independently and as a whole. And I've just seen it so many times in my life that I can't write it off. And I think essentially that is what magic boils down to. I mean, you have an intent, you do something to put yourself in a state where you have the ability to construct that intent and manifest it into the world. That's the basic concept of magic. And it's what Jane Roberts and Seth were talking about decades ago, but in a different light, a different way. And I think, you know, that trickster element is doing that, because if you instill the possibility of that being real in one person, if they have that ability inherently to forcefully create this reality, like Kiel did, like a lot of other people have done, then because of that trickster element planting the seed, you have now made this egregoric entity. You have now changed reality to a reality that includes the thing. And I think really that's what all of this is, man. I think that's what UFOs are. I think that's what aliens are. I think that's what ghosts are. Everyone can do it, but not everyone does it subconsciously. But you can put yourself into that state, whether it be through LSD and the government, or or going to places of power, places that change your vibrational state, mentally, you know, through meditation, through rituals that displace your subconscious, like crazy magic rituals where you put on a robe and you're naked and you have a staff with a serpent on it, and you're lighting candles and pouring the wax over a naked guy in the middle of a circle that has a star on the floor. Like, you're doing something to trick your subconscious to unleash that power, and you do it and it happens. And I think that all these magical rituals and these magical orders are just sort of a different approach to doing that, to thought creates reality. And that's really, to me, where I have taken magic and just applied it through that method, through thought creates reality. And I feel like you don't need all of that, but if you do, it's there. If you feel like you do, you have it at your fingertips.
It's kind of a way of inducing belief. It doesn't matter. The ritual itself, the words and the objects aren't the thing. They're just aids to get you to the place where you can, and I'll put it in a little bit different terms, and tell me if this is kind of what you're talking about. It allows you to have faith, and it allows you to believe, and belief somehow translates into changing reality into the thing you believe it is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I'm not a religious guy. You know, I don't even claim to be a Christian, but I know enough of the Bible to know that a lot of the things that are in there about, well, your faith has healed you, you recovered because you believed it was possible to recover. Things Christ said that, you know, allegedly, I'm not, you know, but I'm not preaching here, but that when the woman touches his robe and is healed, and he tells her, your faith has healed you. Not I've healed you, because I'm God walking around, I got special powers, but your faith has healed you. You believed that it was possible. If you could touch me, you would be healed. And so you touched me and you were healed. That it doesn't seem extremely different. It seems completely the same thing, just in a very different context. Does that
exactly? Yeah.
Sound about right.
You know, and to double back, I mean, Jane Roberts and Seth, actually, there was an entire book about healing. I think it's called like The Way Toward Health or something along those lines back in the, gosh, I want to say like in the mid to late 90s that came out. And Jane Roberts actually had a lot of physical ailments that she was never able to overcome, all while being used as a channel for the Seth entity. And Seth is saying, this is how you heal yourself, you know, with, you know, using your terminology, with your faith, with your power of belief, this is what you can do. But this came like at the end of a long list of other things that were, seemed to be way more important, you know? So it is interesting, the parallels between teachers and handed down knowledge throughout the years, and how, you know, a lot of the stuff that's in the Bible came from other mythologies before that time.
Oh, yes. And,
you know, and I'm really interested in advanced forgotten civilizations and, you know, humanity being much older than what we think we are, and some cataclysm nearly wiping us out. But yeah, who knows the ancient history of the ancients? You know what I mean?
And
people have known, you know, for eons, you know, like how much do we not know that we have to keep rediscovering over and over and over again?
Well, I just say it's interesting to me that Seth, as a non-physical entity, didn't see the physical as probably that important.
Right.
So it's like, oh yeah, by the way, you can just heal yourself by doing this.
Right. Yeah, it's like an app.
You know, it wasn't a priority to him though, because he never had a body or didn't have a body, you know. But exactly. Yes, I am also very interested in the Atlantis, Lemuria type, and I don't mean like necessarily literally in any of the interpretations, but there was some, we didn't start out a few thousand years ago. We've been here a long time, and other things have been here longer than us. So yes, I think so much is lost. And right now, if we had an all-out nuclear war, what would be there in 1,000 years that you could describe our civilization off of?
Not a lot.
Nothing, you know. I mean, you find an object now and again, which would be misinterpreted completely and put in the wrong context. Yes, exactly. You know.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and that makes you really wonder, doesn't it? Like, how many times have we been here? How many times have we done the cycle over and over again? And it goes back to what we started talking about, right? With these civilizations that are underground, or civilizations of the underworld, and what we knew about life and death, and how that has cycled back through the system in different ways. And, you know, maybe at one time there was some civilization underground that did these things, and their actions have echoed out through time, and we're picking up on reverberations of this. And, you know, we're just drawing closer and closer to the singularity. You know what I mean? And
yes.
Knowledge is still physically trapped down there.
That makes a lot of sense. I was just thinking on a very like crudely physical, practical level, if a ancient civilization, high-tech advanced civilization, we have underground bunkers, deep underground bunkers, continuation of government programs, where if we were to have an all-out nuclear war, everybody wouldn't die. There'd be the continuation of the U.S. government in salt mines and in deep underground bunkers that, you know, that are completely acknowledged to exist and have stockpiles. Well, other civilizations would do that too. And so when the cataclysm comes, it wouldn't get everybody. And the survivors would be trying to communicate what they know of their civilization to people who've never experienced it. And I think that happened. I think that's happened more than once.
Yeah, and it makes you think like the importance of the people that were being protected from said cataclysms. Like right now, it's going to be these massive world governments that do terrible things that seemingly have no moral standard that are going to be the ones to carry us on. And you would assume that as time went on, that it would lead to some sort of revolution or possibly not, maybe to some sort of, domination of some sort, for all eternity. But what were the people that survived like at their time in past civilizations, pre-cataclysm? Who were the people that were in the bunkers? Who were the people that carried on? You know what I mean? Right now, it's not going to be the poets and the artists and the spiritualists. It's going to be, agent so-and-so from the U.S. government or the president or Congress.
Unfortunately, it's probably going to be politicians, soldiers, spies. And the tech people that can keep things working. Mm-hmm. Plus almost nothing.
And from their mindset, like, what are they going to spy on? Who are they going to govern if they just let the people that they claim to represent all die in a massive disaster? Like, I don't understand that mentality.
No, it in the big picture doesn't make any sense, but that is a certain aspect of human nature. Maybe what they call the reptile brain,
the tribalism.
Yes. I'm just riffing here, but I'm thinking of, do you ever see the classic episode, The Twilight Zone, where there's been a nuclear war and there's an old man in a cave that advises the survivors on what to do, what to drink and eat, and not what to avoid?
I don't think I've seen that one.
Okay. I cannot recall the title, but it ends up that he's a computer. He's been set aside to survive the apocalypse.
Hmm.
And yes, our plans often end up being very of their time and not universal at all.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
It's a good one. Yes.
So many of them were, though.
Yes. Oh, they have a man. I am often tempted to staying up too late just to watch that in the classic black and white.
Yeah. It's coming up again, though. Like the Sci-Fi Channel does the marathon every year. Like, is it around for New Year's, one of the two?
Yes. It's, I think it's a full 24 hours of on New Year's Day.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think so. We've covered a lot of ground. I wanted to ask you about one thing I have written down before I forget. What would you like to say about the Smoky God?
Oh, man, that's interesting. Yeah, that came up in that interview as well. I don't know what to think about the Smoky God story, right? It draws a lot of parallels to other stories of the Hollow Earth, right? And I don't know. It's interesting that someone from the place they were from, with the belief system that they had, would find the Christian Eden and the rivers named as the rivers from the Bible and all that stuff. It's really interesting, and I feel like religion is used in many ways as a tool and a disguise, that you could make up this extraordinary tale that points you into believing that that religion is real, right? And
yes.
I like you, I'm not a Christian and I'm not a religious person, and I, to be honest, I find it all just, it's a hard pill to swallow that I'm not going to.
There's a whole lot that I'm not going to get into here, but yeah, I got major issues.
I think you know where I'm,
I'm
coming from. Like, there's a really good quote about, no greater evils have been done than those done in the name of religion.
Oh, yes.
Apply that to the Smoky God as, you know, here's a guy that isn't a Christian and he's taken somewhere and now he's talking about Eden and the rivers from the Bible and how it's basically, you know, heaven on earth. And I don't like that aspect, but if that's what happened and that's a true story, you know, I've always said I'm not a Christian, but if Jesus shows up in my driveway, I'll convert.
So fair enough. Yes. Touche. Well, and just to be clear, so everybody knows what we're talking about, The Smoky God was written by a Scandinavian man who believed in the traditional Scandinavian religion, with Odin and Thor and, you know, yeah, that type of thing. And this is back in, correct me if I'm wrong, late 1700s, early 1800s?
I don't recall, honestly. Okay. I read it right around there.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely around that time frame.
Because what rings in my mind, and I don't have the details in front of me, but that I believe it was John Adams, the second president of the United States, wanted to use government money to send an expedition to look for the entrance to the Hollow Earth that fellow was talking about. And it didn't make it through Congress, but he really wanted to do that. And took it completely seriously. And that, you know, take it for what it's worth, but the people at the time did seem to think that that was a viable thing that might happen.
It's interesting to see that come up over and over again in different time periods. I mean, the Nazis also sent people and significant research to Antarctica, you know, and then there's Admiral Byrd, and this is a good example of misinformation. There's the secret diary of Admiral Byrd that he never wrote, but is played off and has made it part of the canon, so to speak, of Hollow Earth stuff. And no one talks about how it's, you know, probably not true, one, and definitely not written by Richard Byrd, except for recently Matthew Byrd, who until recently believed he was related to Admiral Byrd. A lot of revelations there in that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I literally, the next thing on my notes was Admiral Byrd, fact and fiction. And yes, a lot of people believe that Admiral Byrd, who was a very famous in his time, and his time was like from World War I through World War II and into the late 50s, pilot and explorer, and he was given the Medal of Honor for flying over the North Pole, and, you know, a hugely respected figure. But no, he did not write a secret diary where he finds a hollow earth that has, yeah, like tropical lands and, you know, cavemen and animals and stuff. No, that's all fiction. There's like five, I just looking up doing research for the show, found like five different versions. And they're all fiction, and they have slightly different names. The Secret Diary of Admiral Byrd, The Revealed Secret Diary of Admiral Byrd, The True Secret Diary of Admiral Byrd. And it's all fiction. You know, he never said that happened. He's been called into question about whether he ever actually went over the North Pole. But that's like the most controversial thing that anybody seriously questions him on. Because all those books are just fiction, you know, written to make some money and tell an interesting story. But yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because otherwise I was going to bring it up. Yes.
It's interesting to look at it, though, because it goes back to that trickster element. For some reason, someone wanted this to manifest. Someone wanted these entrances to exist. And by putting the story out there, by getting other people to believe it, it's possible that they have manifested these areas where there are quote unquote entrances. And whether that becomes a physical entrance, maybe it becomes some sort of portal that we can't explain through modern science, going back to the non-physical aspect of these things.
Oh, yes.
It's interesting that it has come up so many times in so many different generations of people, that it's important enough to make people believe that it's real. And I think that's what you look at.
And I completely agree. I'm always it's sometimes it seems to me that there are ideas that want to be heard, or that something wants to be heard. I know when Alexander Graham Bell patented the telephone, there were three or four other guys who also invented the telephone, like within a year. It was like a race to the patent office. Well, okay. I mean, that idea had hung out there for thousands of years. We hadn't had telephones. Now, all of a sudden, five people invent it in a year.
Yeah.
It's like that was due to appear. And when you have the same story coming out from different sources, it's like something wants to come into our world and wants to be real and wants you to make it real. And I think that happens.
Yeah, it ties in a lot with what Nathan Isaac and Darian West and Kyle Cadell have been talking a lot about with Penny Royal in their Patreon live streams, that there are these instances in time where this is going to happen, and there are multiple ways that it could happen, but it's going to happen by one of them. This needs to happen right now, and the one that they've focused on a lot lately are important assassinations. And you know, it's fascinating that Archduke Ferdinand's assassin flubs up the murder, and then the convoy of people with Archduke Ferdinand traveling back home, their convoy breaks down, and he goes to this bar and he sits down right next to the guy who just tried to kill him. You know, like, it's gonna happen. You know, if something gets in the way, there's another way that's coming. And yeah, those instances, and they're implying that it might be possible to look at the entropic scale and randomness and these points of low entropy where these things take place. Like 9/11 is one where they measured randomness at being, you know, at an extraordinarily low level. Maybe it's the same thing. Maybe this hollow Earth thing is just going to happen one way or another. Maybe not at this time, but maybe there are several times that it has to happen, or that it's going to happen, because there's a lot of different people from different backgrounds that talk about this stuff. There's almost like the pseudoscientific background. There's the there's the random things like John Uri Lloyd and Etta Dorpa. There's Jules Verne, you know, that they all have these different characteristics and these different backgrounds and a different take on the exact same story. And it's going to happen. It's going to get out there. I totally agree. There are things that want to be recognized one way or another. And I definitely think that maybe the Hollow Earth is one of them.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And yes, I happened to catch the, I listen to it every Monday, the Liminal Lodge from Penny Royal. And yes, the idea that I completely get what they're saying, and I agree with it, that certain events you can't stop from happening. You can't save Kennedy. JFK is going to die, whether Lee Harvey Oswald does it, whether the mafia does it, whether the Cubans do it, you know, on and on and on. It's one of those, it's like somehow fated. And there's several of those, you know, there's many of those events. And the Archduke Franz Ferdinand thing is incredible. Yes, because these series of coincidences that have to happen, you know, it's ludicrous to say that that just happened like that. If it hadn't happened this way, it would have happened that way or that way or that way. And it's, why did that have to happen? I don't know, but it did have to happen. And, you know, I just wanted to mention one thing as far as bringing things into reality. One of the Whitley Strieber books that I have not read, he talks about, I have read, you know, sections of it, but I haven't read it. And so therefore I can't name which one it is. He talks about, by bringing them into the culture, by talking about them and selling millions of books and discussing them the way he does, he's making them real, the visitors. And that really struck home with me, that there are things that want to be made real. And they come to different people and get them to tell my story. I'll give you a good story. Tell it. Make people listen to me. Make people believe in me. And then I'll become real. And that sounds crazy, but that seems to happen over and over.
Yeah, it really does. And it's just bizarre, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. It's
then
like,
you question the motives, like why? Why does this thing have to happen? And that's what's really interesting to me about the Hollow Earth coming up over and over and over again. Like, why is this so important? Why is this such a necessary thing? Why are there so many people that are going to tell this? What is it about it? I don't know. I'd like to know.
It seems like there's something down there that wants us to pay it attention.
And yeah, it does.
And if it's not part of our physical reality yet, it seems to be hanging out there, kind of like Schrodinger's cat, like in quantum physics, you know? Like, if you believe in me, then that'll tip the scale and I'll become real.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds, you and I understand, and the people listening
to
this
understand,
but I wouldn't like talk to a lot of people about that because that sounds completely nuts.
You would write a thesis on it.
I'd be very careful where I submitted it.
Absolutely.
But I do believe that happens because I just see so many examples over time, you know? And, you know, I could take this in a lot of directions, but I didn't mean to keep bringing up the Bible here because that's not the kind of podcast I do. But bear with me for a moment. The Israelites, the ancient Hebrew people at around, you know, 1 AD, were looking for a Messiah. And everybody was looking for one, and then one appeared, and that was, you know, Jesus of Nazareth was certainly not the only one claiming that title before or since. And I mean, there are many. Just Google up a laundry list of claimants to be the Messiah, and you'll find hundreds of people. But it seems like the collective belief and the collective desire for this individual to appear almost created somebody.
Yep.
And that is not a unique one time only thing that happened. I think it's happened over and over. And for different causes that we would see as very good or very bad or somewhere in between. But that seems like when everybody's looking for something, that thing appears. That's just my take.
No, I totally agree with you. And it goes back to thought creating reality and the building blocks of magic. And I see it every day. Like I said before, I've seen it, you know, countless times. And think about things that we write off as coincidence. You've had a song stuck in your head for 3 days. You get in your car, you turn on the radio, and the song is playing. And you think, wow, that's a coincidence. No, you fool. You've been trying to subconsciously manifest this song for 3 days, and now it's happened. You know, that isn't because you did some sort of ritual to make that happen. It's not because you were actively looking for it. In the world that we live in today, you could pull your phone out of your pocket and listen to that song immediately as soon as it pops into your head, but you don't for some reason. And it happens. And it should be like a signpost for people that, hey, look what you have the power to do. But instead, we dismiss it and say, that's silly. That's just coincidence. Isn't that weird, you'd say, when really it's magic telling you, hey, I'm real and you can do this all the time. And that's like, why are we that way? Why are we in a society now where we have dismissed this very real thing that everyone encounters and still says is horseshit? You know what I mean?
Oh, yes. And I realize maybe you meant that as a rhetorical question, but I have an answer for that.
I did, but I'm glad you do.
Honestly, I'll just put it out there, and it is what it is. But if we all knew our actual abilities, our actual lack of limitations, our ability to change reality based on our will, it would be awfully hard to keep a hierarchy going. It'd be awfully hard to enforce the inequality that we live in every day. Mm-hmm. If everybody knew, I'm not just, 250 pounds of meat, I am an eternal being that can affect reality by my will, that'd be a very different world. And people who, it seems to me that when you get to the really powerful, the 1% of the 1%, they all know this stuff. That's my impression. And yeah, they prefer that just they know it. And the rest of us pay no attention. And to me, that's why I just can't stand materialist reductionism, which says, no, you just are 250 pounds of meat. That's it. You were born on this date, you'll die sometime, and then you will not exist, game over. And there's nothing more of you. I don't believe that at all. And I don't believe while they claim the mantle of science, they don't know any of that stuff, and they can't prove any of that stuff. But I feel that movement is almost kept going because it keeps the powerful in power. And there's a pretty smooth transition from the church ruling society and saying, okay, you live a good life, you do what we tell you, you'll go to heaven, but you'll be a peon for the rest of your life here, okay? And science saying, oh, you don't even have that to look forward to. You're just a physical entity, and once you're done, you're done. And neither of those are empowering, okay? And everything that is empowering, whether it be through miraculous religious experience, whether it be through magic, whether it be through folk magic like voodoo, all of that is totally demonized because those in power don't want those not in power to be able to alter reality or to know who they are. They don't want them to know who they are. Us to know who we are. That's just my take on it, but I do believe.
No, you're right. I'll try to expand on it a little bit. The two systems at play are not compatible right now, because my kids are, and I'm sure other children are this way, and I'm sure everyone is like this at one point, thinks, wouldn't it be great if everything was free and you could just get whatever you wanted? Yeah, that would be great, except if it's free, no one's making any money. No one's being paid to make it. No one's going to make it, right? So indeed, you can't have everything in the system that we're in. But I will get a little topical, and I'll bring up Elon Musk. Because I caught some clip from some interview with him. Dozens of times I've come across this where he talks about the emergence of AI and the emergence of robotics becoming much more commonplace, doing these remedial tasks and establishing a universal basic income and things like that. And I think in a system that's more geared on that side, where you don't need people to can vegetables on a large scale to be sold in a store, and those people now don't have to work and they can still live, then you're getting closer to a place where these two realities can coexist. And I think that's not the end point. There has to be another jump past that. And I don't think we'll ever see that. And maybe that point is when everything falls apart and the center ceases to hold and there's a major cataclysm and we start over again. These two opposing forces, not necessarily good and evil, but in a lot of ways good and evil, where you have to have people in charge and you have to have hierarchy, but there it also exists a force within everyone that is being ruled over to completely change their own reality. And really, what is reality? You look at it like everything that is real to you only exists in your mind right now, and you can't verify the contents of your reality to anyone else. Who's to say what I call red is what you call red, and that we're seeing the same thing when we say that item is red? We cannot prove that we are. And this is something else that Seth talks about, is this sort of camouflage that exists in this system that is in place to allow us to exchange ideas regardless of how we interpret the data, that we can all understand what each other is talking about. And I can say, this hat is red, and you can say, well, that hat is red, but we might be seeing red as a totally different thing from one another. So unleashing that into the materialistic, sadistic existence that we live in right now, it's just not compatible. Like you said, it's not going to work. But I don't know that we'll ever achieve that state where we can make these two things compatible. And until we do, until we get there, you're right. This is not going to be taken at face value. It's going to be dismissed. It's going to be demonized. It's going to be the laughing stock. But we have the potential in our fingertips to change our own realities. And maybe everyone needs to focus on their own personal reality instead of changing everyone else's reality with them.
I think that's a very good point. As far as perception, we collectively saw that with, I don't know if you remember from a few years ago, the blue or gold dress.
Exactly, yeah.
And people are looking at this. I'm looking at this thing and I'm saying, well, it's clearly this, but other people, no, it's that. And nobody was defective. We were seeing two different things and interpreting it in two different ways.
Yeah.
As what you were saying, it makes me think of a book that I now can't give the exact title, but it was basically called Luxury Deluxe Communism. And it was saying that if we have the technology we have now and the wealth we have now, really everybody could be in the 1%. But that's very unlikely to happen. But it is a utopia that we could make happen if we all wanted to. However, I think it's a hell of a lot more realistic to have it happen for you as an individual, one at a time, rather than a society go that way, because I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that if we spend our entire lives wondering why life sucks so much, that we're missing the point, because I do believe in a spiritual sense that the earth is like a school. I mean, I believe in reincarnation. I believe in life between lives. And I don't think this is our entire existence right now that we're living in. I think we are here for our own individual reasons, whether that be to experience a particular thing or to figure out how to conquer a certain emotion or just be there for somebody else's existence that we are completely unaware of the impact of. There are several things that we are doing right now for a reason. And we all chose to be here right now in this life, as much as it sucks. So I think it's important that everyone take a step back from Fox News and CNN and the stock market and Twitter and figure out something that you can take away as a positive. And really, I don't know, find some reason to keep going just to fulfill whatever obligations that you forgot you made. You know, like, you're here for a reason, whether that be what you think is some religious reason or otherwise. You know, it's important. We're here now for whatever ridiculous reason we're here in this awful time right now, as much as we could sit here and say, wouldn't it be great if it was like this and everybody did magic and blah, 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 and so, and no one had to work. We're here now for whatever reason. And we should accept that as well when we're talking about the injustices of the world.
That makes a lot of sense. And we have not discussed reincarnation before, I don't think. But I also am very much a believer in that. Some of the most intense experiences I've had in my life have been recollections of a past life. And I do think that we come back again and again and again. And, you know, I don't have a whole system for it, but and I don't really like any of the ones that I'm aware of, but other than Jack London, the Star Rover, where his hero comes, it's like a book from the very early 1900s, where his character just comes back over and over to have adventures on Earth because he likes it. But no, I totally believe that we do repeat lives over and over, and that there very almost certainly is a choice in the matter. And that you are where you are to some extent because you need to be there. That makes a lot of sense to me.
One of the things that got me into that way of thinking and got me into examining possibilities of this stuff was I read a book early on in my journey, I like to say, by Michael Newton. He's a clinical hypnotherapist. He wrote this book when he accidentally stumbled upon somebody's past life memories. And it began his whole career change into focusing just on researching that. And the book was called Journey of Souls. And I think he wrote 3, maybe 4 books on this. He passed away not too long ago. But one of the things that was brought up was, what about babies that are either born stillborn or that are aborted or that die gestationally? What reason would someone choose that to be their life, where they would put their soul in that position? And I paused and I couldn't think of a reason why. And it's because of the mindset that we all have. It's like, well, how is that going to be beneficial to me if I were to be put in that position? And it's explained that maybe the father needed to be in a life where they lost a child. Wow. And that's what they needed. And you agreed to fulfill that role for them. And that's why we're here. We're not just here for us. We're here for other people too. So I try to live my life that way a little bit.
Wow, that's heavy. You saying that made me think of a very old episode of Coast to Coast when Art Bell was still doing it. And his guest addressed that very question. He'd written a book on past life memories of children. And one of them was a woman she had an abortion and then a couple of years later had a child. And the child spoke early, precociously, which you get some very interesting memories coming out then because they fade away as the kid gets older.
Sure.
But the child said, "This isn't my first time here. The first time you took me out and put me in a jar. But I'm back now."
Holy shit.
And that's what I said. I was like, whoa, okay. But yes, so I don't pretend to explain stuff, but that made a lot of sense to me that, we're eternal beings. And while we all probably have an innate fear of death, really, it's just a road sign, and we continue whatever happens to us. And that is how I see it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Michael Newton, in his work, boils down and focuses on the things that happen between lives and comes to the conclusion through all of these different subjects that we have what they refer to as soul groups. groups of our souls that sort of go through this whole process together. And maybe in one life we all come in and you and I are husband and wife, and my son is my dad, and my younger son is my uncle or my aunt, even, because gender is nothing to a soul, to eternity, gender is nothing. And we accomplish our individual goals. We're there to support each other in these goals. And maybe the next life, one of us needs to be an enemy with the other, and we become this in this heated rivalry, right? This huge emotional impact for whatever reason that we need to learn this thing. We need to experience this thing, and we come back and we understand we were playing a role. We were basically in a thought experiment in a way. And that's what I found really fascinating about Michael Newton's work. And that became a really big building block in my spirituality, was being able to look through a different lens at existence and at reality. And when I coupled that with the teachings from Seth, then I unlocked the magical aspect of, these are the things that you can also do while you're here, by the way.
You know? Wow.
So that's really, like, talking about religion and things, like those two, like, collections of work is what I refer to as my religion, because it formed those blocks, those building blocks for me, for my reality. Like, this is what I'm going with. I'm just running with it, you know, because none of us really know. Right,
yes,
now, you know,
but that's really interesting. Just let me throw in a personal experience that fits exactly with what you've just said. My daughter spoke very early, like when she was 1 year old, and she once looked right at my wife, her mother, and said, "You're my mother now, but I was your mother last time."
Aha, there you go.
And that. And the timeline worked out because of the death of my mother-in-law, that it made sense when she said it. And that was a moment. We had a moment there. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, right? Like, you come across things like that every so often. And one of the things that I've always looked at was, like, people that were really important to me at different periods of my life that I now have zero contact with. It's like, I wonder, like, are you from my group back home? Like, was this what you were here for this time? You know, and now you also have these other things that you have to do with other people, you know, that just makes me feel insignificant, though, in some ways. Like, I was only important once, but I'm still here, you know.
There's probably
that's
multiple
the beauty
missions.
Of it. Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, that's it. That's... we get so hung up on, like, you know, our jobs and climbing to the top of the ranks, or, you know, being the best at flute, or, you know, whatever it is that you're into, you know, and you don't think about all of it. So it's really hard to do that. But I think when you can find those meaningful things, like those random pop-ups like that, like with what your daughter had said, like, you know, that's awesome. And it's just like another one of those things, another signpost now, you know, for me, that's probably what's going on. And just to clarify, I came here prepared to talk about the Hollow Earth. This was not a setup. Like,
no, I agree. This totally has been spontaneous. All my notes are about caves and stuff. I didn't even get to the dog that was found 500 feet underground in the cave. That happened, but
we'll just do that next time.
Yes, exactly. This flowed in a different direction, but it flowed in the way it should go, you know.
Dude, it always does, doesn't it?
Yes, you know? Indeed. Yes, indeed.
It's just the way it is, you know. These conversations are often had between people with the capacity to have them. And when they happen, you just take advantage of it and you roll with it, because I know I don't get these opportunities very often.
That is very true. And when you get that kind of, I don't know, when you're on the same vibration, for lack of a better term, yeah, it goes where it's supposed to go. And sometimes that's very different than what you had mapped out, but that's okay.
That's okay.
It's really great, you know. And I've thoroughly enjoyed this time here.
Oh, absolutely, man. This has been a blast. Hell, we've been going for a long time.
we're pushing 2 hours, yes.
Yeah, this is a multi-parter. This is my first ever part A, part B.
Well, good. I'm thinking we should probably wrap things up.
Sure.
Just as I'm running out of time. And I think my Zoom capability only lasts for so long.
Sure.
But it's been great talking to you, Jason. And
absolutely,
certainly this is not the last time at all.
Oh, I hope not.
No way, man. We're going to do this. Is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't touched on?
Oh, dude, we could talk about things.
Truthfully, yeah, we could be here like till the sun comes up. But I guess maybe we should do that another time.
Yeah, let's definitely do it another time, because I'm curious about this dog found 500. I don't even like dogs, so I got to get that story. But I want it to feel spontaneous. So
absolutely, yeah. We'll get there. We shall get there.
No, that's wonderful.
Well, hey, thanks for being a guest, and it's my pleasure to be your guest. And do you want to say a few words to wrap things up?
I'd like to say some sort of come listen to my podcast and listen to all of your podcast episodes and things of that nature. But really, I think after having this conversation, I think what I just want to end with is, we have to do a better job at being better, because the world sucks right now, and we have capability to impact other people's lives, both negatively and positively. And you should really strive to be a positive impact on those around you. And I'm not speaking to you, Mr. Vincent Treewell. I'm not calling you out. I'm speaking to anyone listening. Just be a better human being, and you are probably already a good one. So just give it a little bit more tomorrow. And that's all I have to say.
Man, that's like perfect. Thank you, Jason. I have nothing to add to that. Yes, do what he said.
Yes. So it's like those Christmas lights all done up on someone's house, and then the next house it says what he said on the sign.
Yes, indeed. Well, hey, I'm going to bring this recording to a close. And
absolutely.
Just say that this is the weird part. I'm Vincent Treewell. My special guest has been Jason Andrews. Thank you very much for appearing. Thank you all for listening, and have a good night.
Good night, everyone. Excellent.
Oh, yeah, that went really nice. Give me 1 second to...